Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast from noon to 1 on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe, and producer, Gus Canifaro. In the War Report, we report on recent developments in war and geopolitics around the world. By placing these developments in historical context, we show how they affect global stability and U.S. national security. In the past month, the Islamic State has captured Ramadi, the capital of Anbar province in Iraq. This is the province that's just to the west of the capital of the country, Baghdad. This happened despite stepped-up U.S. airstrikes and the fact that the U.S. was supplying plenty of weapons and ammo to the Iraqi troops, and despite the U.S. efforts to train Iraqi Sunni fighters. When the Iraqi army left Ramadi, it left behind a huge cache of weapons supplied by the United States as well as Russia, including RPGs and heavy machine guns. These weapons, of course, are now in the hands of the Islamic State. Marshawn, what do you make of the defeat of the Iraqi army in Ramadi? What are the long-term implications?
When we analyze the defeat of the Iraqi army in Ramadi, one of the things we can tell is there was a lack of presence of the Shia militias and a lack of presence of Iranian military advisors. The Iraqi army, when left to its own devices, cannot stand on its own. And the Battle of Ramadi is the perfect example of that. The reason why they were able to retake the city of Tikrit was by and large thanks to the help of Iranian military advisors and Shiite militiamen. Now, it appears that they were afraid to commit Shiite militiamen and Iranian military advisors to the battle in Ramadi because Ramadi is the capital of Anbar province, which is in the Sunni heartland. So the Iraqi government was afraid of imposing something that could be interpreted as sectarian. At least that's my opinion. The problem is what it demonstrates is the total ineffectiveness of the U.S.-led airstrikes. The airstrikes are great, but at the end of the day, without the boots on the ground to actually provide that muscle to actually stop the enemy advance, to actually hold a hill, to actually hold a city, the airstrikes are virtually meaningless. And who knows how well-coordinated they were with the Iraqi troops on the ground.
Doesn't it also show the ineffectiveness of the Iraqi army? As we reported in our show last month, the Iraqi army has a nominal strength of 240,000 soldiers. That's on paper. But one estimate says that there yeah, actually right. as few as 50,000 soldiers in the Iraqi army, the rest being phantoms for which the mm-hmm. Iraqi generals, who some of whom are corrupt, are collecting salaries.
Well, absolutely. And that's one of the big problems is that the Iraqi army is very demoralized. It is very poorly organized, poorly led. There's massive amount of corruption, and it doesn't have enough troops. When you look at actually a lot of the photographs that came out of Ramadi after the fighting, you see a lot of the vehicles were just simply abandoned. You know, some of them were shot up pretty bad. I mean, the Iraqi army, there were elements of the Iraqi army that did fight, and I'll give credit where credit is due to those that did fight. But a lot of them, you could tell they just, when ISIS closed in, the Iraqi army broke. They broke and they fled. When they're backed by the Shiite militiamen, and when they're backed by Iran's professional army, again, Iran is different than Iraq. Iran has a professional army, and their military advisors are professional soldiers. When the Iraqi army is being propped up by the Shiite militiamen and the Iranian military advisors, they hold their ground. Now, this would have been a great role for U.S. military advisors because it would have been a third party, would have been something non-sectarian to help out the Iraqis. But when we come in with just airstrikes, it's very apparent that the airstrikes are useless without the professional soldiers there to help prop up the Iraqis, because very clearly the Iraqi army by itself is not capable of resisting ISIS. And the loss of Ramadi basically hands control of all of Anbar to ISIS.
Some of the Anbar leaders went ahead and requested the Shia militias to come in and help anyway, despite the fact that there are some sectarian differences. They really are afraid of being overrun by ISIS, and they were willing to put their differences aside, yet the United States government did not want them to get the help. Do you think that there is some sort of underlying goal here, or they're really that obstinate about wanting to make sure that the Iran allies don't get a foothold or win some good graces in the area?
part of the fear, certainly from the administration, has been this idea that we can't allow Iran to gain influence. And certainly the worst thing in terms of Iran gaining influence would be as if Iranians now, or Iranian-backed militias, were now liberating Sunni areas. That's a nightmare scenario. Right. Now, the fact is you can't have your cake and eat it too. We have to look at human nature. If you're an Iraqi soldier, right, your army is collapsing, and you look to your left, and there's a Shia militia man, and you look to your right, and there's an Iranian soldier, well, who are you going to think are your friends? Now, if you were to look to your left and right and see that the guy having your back was an American, then they'd be our friends. If we say, well, we're not going to commit on the ground, we're going to let the Iranians do the fighting, and we're going to let the Shia militiamen do the fighting, well, then you're going to get, it's kind of, you get what you pay for. Naturally, they're going to be brought closer into the sphere of Iran.
Another consideration, Marchand, is that the Islamic State is very anti-Shia. So doesn't that hold some appeal for some of the Sunnis in Iraq?
In some ways, yes. Some of the Sunni tribesmen are very alienated by ISIS's rabid anti-Shia stance. But for a lot of others, they view the Shia as a proxy of Iran and a proxy of the United States. So for some Sunnis, it does hold an appeal. When we look at what motivates the ISIS leader, the ISIS fighters, well, what motivates the ISIS leadership is a drive for power. It's not religion. It's a drive for power. They just wrap themselves in the banner of religion. But when we look at what motivates the average ISIS cadre, it seems to be by and large, I mean, they're motivated for different reasons, but by and large, it's political. The Shia are their rivals. The Shia are the people who kept them out of power after Saddam. Because when Saddam was in power, the Sunnis ruled the roost.
Now ISIS may be benefiting from the fact that the Sunnis have been squeezed out of power by the Shia. And we don't really know how happy the people of Mosul are, the Sunnis in Mosul are, with the occupation by the Islamic State. From our perspective,
not a lot
in the West,
of tweets coming out of there.
Yeah, from our perspective, it's a horror show. But on the other hand, maybe the Islamic State is finding a fairly compliant population. I really don't know the answer to that question.
To add a wrinkle to that, it's also during a war, and as everyone knows, governments are in lockdown mode during a war, right? And they become more powerful, and they galvanize support by saying, "Look, the Americans are going to come and bomb you any minute now, so we need to really hold together." It's not until peacetime, or alleged peacetime, that you actually find out what a government governs like. We don't know how they govern.
And also, Marchand, is the Islamic State becoming a government? The Islamic State now has radio stations. They're even broadcasting from Mosul in English. So they're starting to have some of the indicia of a real state. And as we'll soon be talking about in Syria, they're collecting revenues from oil, the sale.
Black market oil.
So they're going to have money. And I wonder how long it is before other countries may start to deal with the Islamic State.
I've looked at the numbers at that, actually. It's interesting. The amount of money that they make a day is in the millions, but they have a lot of people to pay. Just because they are a religious caliphate doesn't mean people fight for free. So they have a large geographical area that they have to manage now, many cities that they have to follow or to manage, and it takes a lot of money. So the amount of money that they're making is really about break even for the ground that they have to manage and pay. So it's not that they're raking in the bucks, they're making just enough to pay for what they need at the moment. And the more sanctions that the United States government imposes on other countries, or Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah, or whoever else that's out there, they are more likely to buy from ISIS. So actually easing sanctions on these other countries and normalizing trade relations is the best thing that we can do to combat the black market oil.
And when we look at the ISIS cadre, most of the senior leadership are ex-Ba'athist intelligence officers. When we look at a lot of the leadership, these guys are former captains, colonels, majors, generals, not just in Saddam's army, but more importantly, the Muhabarat, Saddam's elite intelligence wing. The importance of this is that Saddam's intelligence wing were experts at selling oil on the black market during the years of U.S. embargo following the first Gulf War. Uh-huh. So they have the same contacts that they possessed in the Saddam years. They're just using them now under the ISIS banner. This is not Al-Qaeda. This is not the Taliban. These guys are not just an organization. They have become ipso facto a state because they now print their own currency. They now have their own passports, own birth certificates. But more importantly than anything, what defines a state is a system of administration. When the Taliban took power, they had a very loose, it wasn't really a system of administration. And Al-Qaeda, of course, anything they take over, it's just, warlords, basically. But when you look at ISIS, what makes the Islamic State unique as a terrorist entity is they have a massive, massive administrative apparatus. You know, you have the caliph at the top, and then you have a shura council, the religious council. But then underneath, you have bureaucrats. You have an absurd number of bureaucrats, guys who are in charge of the basically the Department of Light and Power for the city of Mosul. You have an engineering department. You have public works department. You have a health department.
They are actually running a fair number of cities now in Syria and Iraq.
They're providing order. They have a police force. They have a religious police. I want to make it clear, I'm not justifying these are good guys. What I'm trying to say is that they have a system for ensuring standardization of market prices. One of the things their police do, and it was actually on Vice News when they snuck a guy into ISIS territory, their job is to go sure and make sure people aren't overcharging the marketplace. It's a centralized administration, which creates the auspices of a nation state. Whether you're in Mosul or whether you're in Raqqa, you're going to pay the same price for bread, for example. What that means is there's a centralized sense of order. So wherever you're traveling, if you're a citizen of the Islamic State, quote unquote, and you're a Sunni and you follow their very strict Stalinist laws, there is an element of certainty. There's an administration. And that's what makes it very dangerous. And that's what makes them a state, is because they're not just holding territory. They're administering it, and they're administering it in a way that a government would administer it.
Now, Marshawn, Gus mentioned that the Islamic State is functioning in large part on profits from black market oil and gas sales. And this month, a U.S. Delta Force commando team raided the residence of Abu Sayyaf, who was allegedly in charge of raising funds for the Islamic State through these oil and gas black market operations. Sayyaf was assassinated by the commandos and his wife was taken prisoner. Does this represent a significant escalation in our involvement in Syria where this attack took place?
Realistically speaking, it was a PR stunt for domestic consumption, because knocking this guy out, okay, so they'll find another bureaucrat who's good at math. They have the bureaucracy to replace these people. Unlike a terrorist organization where you might knock out a senior leader and then the organization starts to lose its unity and fracture, this is a bureaucracy. When somebody dies, they have a deputy minister of defense who becomes the minister of defense. From a military standpoint, we have to approach this the way we would if we were to fight another country, another army, another government, because they have all the bureaucracy of it. So ergo, you can't just knock off one guy and hope that the system fractures and crumbles, as Gus said, because it's not going to.
And Marshawn, another important development in the Middle East is that the Saudis are threatening to acquire nuclear weapons if the United States signs this nuclear treaty with Iran. Of course, the Saudis had financed the development of the Pakistani nuclear program, so the Saudis feel pretty confident that they can get that technology from Pakistan. Is this just an idle threat, or do you think the Saudis really want to go nuclear?
The Saudis want a deterrent to Iran. On the other hand, nobody in the region can afford to use nuclear weapons because they're all packed in so tight. But let's say the Saudis had the bomb for the sake of argument. What on earth would they do with it? They drop a nuke on Iran. They're so close to each other. A nuclear war, you'd obliterate each other by hitting your opponent.
Now, Marshawn, if I could quickly move on to Egypt, because the elected president of Egypt, who was deposed after only 1 year in office, has been sentenced to death by the new military regime. How could this come about that a man was elected president as a result of the Arab Spring, ends up being in prison and now sentenced to be executed?
I spent a lot of time in Egypt when Mubarak was president, and Mubarak was, well, he was a jerk, you know, to put it mildly. You know, he was a jerk, and you know, kind of place where if the police wanted your iPod, they just take it. So when popular sentiment revolted against Mubarak, the U.S. I think very rapidly realized we need to bet on another horse, because Mubarak is losing this fight. He's gonna lose. It's better that we back somebody who's gonna be popular with the people, that, you know, we can have confidence in. Morsi was the only viable candidate. When you look at, like, the other candidates, particularly Mohamed al-Baradei, who the West brought up as, you know, oh, this guy's a future leader of Egypt. Al-Baradei hadn't lived in Egypt in a very, very long time. Egyptians that I knew didn't relate to him. In England, exactly. The reason why they liked Morsi, they didn't necessarily agree with his opinions, but it's because the Muslim Brotherhood, this is the first time they were able to run openly. They'd always been persecuted. They were always revolutionaries. So a lot of Egyptians looked at them and said, well, you know what? It's new. It's different. Let's give it a try. And I think Morsi, one of the things the United States liked about him is he didn't like the Shia and he didn't like the Russians. So there was an element that, okay, this guy's in our camp. We can kind of keep the reins on him. We have some common ground. The problem is I think our intelligence services. They might have been aware that this might happen. They might not have. But it's my opinion that the Russian FSB, the successor to the KGB, who have been old hats at this game, orchestrated the toppling of Mohamed Morsi and the bringing to power of General El-Sisi. General El-Sisi, after coming to power, immediately called Moscow. He ignored all phone calls from Washington and called Moscow. And another sign that El-Sisi is a Russian agent is the fact that El-Sisi went to the May Day parade. If he was an ally of the U.S.
This is the May Day parade in Russia.
Exactly, or also called the Victory Day parade on the 9th of May to celebrate the end of World War II. El-Sisi went to the Victory Day parade. The U.S. leaders and all the Western leaders spurned the Victory Day parade, but El-Sisi went and the Premier of China and several other leaders went. But the significant thing is this demonstrates whose camp is El-Sisi, is El-Sisi in? He is in the Russian camp. And so when El-Sisi came to power, it was, in my opinion, an FSB-backed coup, and it caught us unawares. We've been toppling governments really since the end of the Cold War, and nobody's been able to topple our pro-American government. So I think we got lax.
So we've gone from Mubarak, who was basically an American-backed authoritarian leader, to Morsi, who we didn't really want at first, but became reconciled to having him in power. And then our influence has slipped again with his replacement by a pro-Russian general, El-Sisi.
Egyptians are comfortable with generals. They might not necessarily like it, but you look at every Egyptian president since their independence, since the removing of King Farouk, has been a general. There was a brief period when the free officers took power. Gamal Abdel Nasser became president. And then after Gamal Abdel Nasser, you had Anwar Sadat, another general. And then after Anwar Sadat was murdered, you had Hosni Mubarak, who was another general.
Marshawn, one other item in the Middle East I want to briefly mention is that the Vatican announced that it plans to recognize the Palestinian state. And we'd reported that Sweden is going to recognize the Palestinian state. Most countries in the world, except for the United States and its closest allies in Western Europe, have recognized the Palestinian state. Is the momentum building so that there is really nothing going to stop a two-state solution?
The Palestinians have a right to a state. So do the Israelis. And both sides are starting to become reconciled. The Palestinians have made huge steps in becoming reconciled towards the existence of Israel. Now you have extreme organizations like Hamas, but you have the Fatah in the West Bank, and they're becoming reconciled that, you know, we got to live with the Israelis. And there's a movement now in Israel, and more so in the rest of the world as well, saying the only solution is a two-state solution, because it's that philosophy of if we don't learn to live together, we're going to die together. Because the Israelis' overzealousness of the 1948 generation is changing because, you know, your third generation Israeli, that's your home. You can't go anywhere else. And the same thing for the Palestinians. They can't go anywhere else. They're not going to go live in Jordan. They have their right to their home as well. So I think the world, not just in Israel, but in the rest of the world, and not just in Palestine, is starting to realize the only viable solution is the two-state solution.
Actually, I think the biggest roadblock to this peace between Israel and Palestine are the older generations, because the older Palestinians, they have a long memory that goes back to, you know, all these battles and having all of their family killed in bombing raids or have been arrested and harassed for all these years. And then on the Israeli side, the older Israelis have long memories as well of things going back the other way. And they, of course, remember the Holocaust and things like that. The younger generations, as these old events are no longer fresh in their minds, they definitely seem like they're softer on reaching some kind of agreement with each other.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and producer Gus Cadavero. And we've been talking about the advances of the Islamic State in Iraq and other developments in the Mideast. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month from noon to 1. To download a copy of the show and sign up for podcasts, visit our website, incontextreport.com. Now, Marshawn, I'd like to move on to Europe. Since Moscow's recovery of the Crimea and the outbreak of the military conflict in Ukraine last year, NATO forces have expanded their military maneuvers along the Russian border in the Baltic states and throughout Eastern Europe. And I just want to mention some recent exercises. In the Baltic states, NATO troops are engaged in two ground exercises in Lithuania and Estonia. 20 NATO warships are conducting military drills off the coast of Lithuania. And in Romania this month, soldiers of the 2nd Cavalry Regiment, 2nd Squadron, began something called Operation Cavalry March, a 400-kilometer movement across Romania involving nearly nearly 100 combat vehicles and more than 300 U.S. soldiers. This is part of a large series of exercises called Operation Atlantic Resolve. And also in Georgia, the United States held 2 weeks of war games this month. The Georgian Defense Secretary announced that Georgia intends to join NATO as soon as possible. So why in particular are these places so important strategically to Russia? I'm thinking now in particular of Romania and Georgia, which lie to Russia's south, Georgia being on the east side of the Black Sea and Romania on the west side of the Black Sea. Historically, why is this area so sensitive to the Russians and why are we pressing on these regions?
Romania has historically been important because it is on Europe's far eastern flank. It is a buttress against a incursion into Eastern Europe and a flanking of Western Europe because of the Carpathian Mountains. The Carpathian Mountains are very dense, beautiful mountains. They were actually the buttress against the Ottoman Empire at one point. That's why Romania was so important during the rise of the Ottoman Empire. I mean, I'm sure most of our listeners have heard of Vlad Tepes, also known as Dracula, Vlad the Impaler. He was a very important figure, to many Romanians a hero, because he held the Carpathians against the advancing Ottoman forces. And really, that's what helped stall an Ottoman advance into Western Europe. So likewise, if there were to be any sort of Russian advance into Eastern Europe or an attempt to flank and surround Western Europe, it would most likely have to go through Romania. And so Romania is a very strong fortress, a line of defense, I should say, against any Russian attempt on Western or Eastern Europe. Georgia, on the other hand, is very important because not only is there a crucial oil pipeline that passes through Georgia, but also because Georgia borders Chechnya, as well as Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Abkhazia and South Ossetia are two breakaway republics that are pro-Russian and predominantly controlled from Moscow. Chechnya, of course, is part of Russia. It's a nominal republic of its own, but it is part of Russia. The Russians, a pro-NATO Georgia, is a threat because in their mind's eye, whether this would actually take place or not is anybody's guess, but in their mind's eye, a pro-Western Georgia could mean that it would help limit their access to the Caspian Sea, but also, more importantly, it would be a conduit through which arms and agents provocateurs could travel into Chechnya to stir up trouble. Russia has struck a very delicate balance because Russia has a tremendously large Muslim population. One statistic I read was almost 20%. If unrest were to suddenly start sparking up again in Chechnya, significant unrest, it could spread to the rest of Russia.
And of course, I want to remind listeners that Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia were all parts of the Soviet Union for most of the 20th century. So they are very close, not just geographically, but politically and historically to Russia.
Well, and even before then, they were part of the Russian Empire, too, at the time of the Tsars.
Russia historically has not sought to have conquests all around the world. Russia's concern has always been to control the buffer areas around Russia to protect themselves against a repetition of the horrible invasions they've experienced in the past. Rather, it was from the Mongols in the 1300s or from the Germans in the 20th century. Now, Russia is attempting to respond to NATO's pressing its border areas with new alliances. And you mentioned earlier the May Day parade in Russia. It was interesting that Chinese troops marched in the parade this year, that, as you mentioned, it was attended by General Sisi from Egypt. And Egypt has also, like Iran, received these advanced S-300 missiles from Russia, these very powerful mobile missile systems that we talked about in detail in the last show. How effective are these alliances, do you think, going to be in countering the pressure from NATO?
I think they're going to be very effective. The Egyptians have a very large army. The Iranians have a very large army, very well equipped and very well trained.
Of course, the Chinese have countless soldiers.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, actually, the Chinese have agreed to buy from the Russians the latest S-400 surface-to-air missile system. Now, just to give you some idea, the S-300, there was a former naval officer who declined to be identified, but he, during an interview, had said that the S-300 is capable of hitting all of our aircraft, with the exception, and in theory, because it hasn't gone toe-to-toe with our aircraft yet, but in theory, all of our aircraft, with the exception of the F-35, which is not airborne capable, and the B-2 bomber. The F-22, maybe, but the B-2 bomber is the only one that we can say with confidence is untouchable by the S-300. Now, that having been said, the S-400, we have no idea what that really is capable of, because that is the even newer model that they're now selling to the Chinese. And so the Chinese are probably the most important ally, because while Iran and Egypt can threaten us in the Middle East and threaten our influence in the Middle East, more importantly, cut off our access to oil if there were a war, not only that, but the Chinese are able to pose a serious threat in Asia, because there really is no army in Asia that can truly stand up to the Chinese.
Yeah,
to the
yes,
Japanese.
Marshawn, and as we pointed out in past shows, the Chinese are moving methodically to expand their influence in Asia, claiming greater territorial water control, expanding their air flights in Asia, and building these artificial islands, which they're going to be used as ports. In addition to their expansion in the Pacific to challenge the United States, they're also building a greater presence in Antarctica. They're building their fifth research station in Antarctica, constructing a $300 million ice-breaking ship. They just signed an agreement with Australia that's going to permit resupply of Chinese ships in Australia. And of course, Australia is a very strong NATO ally. It's interesting, they're giving hundreds of Chinese names to locations in Antarctica. Now, Antarctica is right now off limits for military operations and mining operations. However, everyone believes that Antarctica has significant oil and mineral resources, as well as high protein sea life. So it's a very promising place for countries to try to control, and the day may come when the treaties that are currently protecting Antarctica are just torn up. China is also expanding in the Mediterranean
as
a show of strength with Russia by conducting a joint naval exercise there.
If I could add that CNN reported that the Chinese issued 8 warnings to the United States about U.S. surveillance drones flying over their man-made islands that you just mentioned. And former CIA Deputy Director, this is as reported by CNN, Michael Morell told CNN's Aaron Burnett that the confrontation indicates there is absolutely, in quotes, a risk of the U.S. and China going to war sometime in the future. So there is clearly, you know, we're spying over them. They're aware of our spy planes, so we're no longer stealth to them. They're completely aware that they're being watched.
As we've talked about many times over the past year, shows the folly of the unwise direction of U.S. policy.
Hubris?
To confront and antagonize the Russians, because there's no reason why we shouldn't have a good relationship with the Russians.
Right. Well, we've always acted as if we were top dog, like we were unquestionably the toughest man on the block. And now all of a sudden we have very legitimate opposition that needs to be treated like adults.
Exactly. And with the Russians, as our cooperating with the Russians, China would be much easier to deal with. But by antagonizing the Russians, we're forcing the Russians and the Chinese into a military alliance that I think is more than we can handle. And as I mentioned, the Chinese and the Russians are now, this month, are conducting naval exercises in the Mediterranean.
The Russians and the Chinese are not natural allies anymore. These aren't the days of the Soviet Union. Russia is a multi-ethnic, multi-religious state. It is nominally capitalist. And I mean, yes, it's an authoritarian dictatorship that doesn't hold the same value systems we do, but they're much more Western than the Chinese are. The Chinese, we forget, while they have a lot of elements of monopoly capitalism, they are still a communist state.
Right.
They are still anti-religion. I mean, they persecute Christians, Muslims, Buddhists. They're still committing genocide in Tibet. They are not inherently our allies. A war could be prevented if we were closer with the Russians, because the Russians want to look west. They want to have a more Western lifestyle. Okay, they want their sphere of influence. They want their buffer zone. Fine, really, is Ukraine worth spilling American blood over? But on the other hand, China, they really have a drive to want to dominate Asia and the Pacific, and they stand for everything that the West doesn't stand for. And so that makes them much more inherently a potential adversary. What prevented war in the past has always been balances, making the concept of war too costly for any one side. But now that we pushed the Russians and the Chinese into a mutual alliance, we really face that possibility with their combined military power that a war no longer guarantees mutual destruction.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and producer Gus Cantavero. Our website is incontextreport.com, and we're broadcasting the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN from noon to 1 p.m. And we've been talking this afternoon about the Mideast, the recent developments in Iraq with the Iraqi army's retreat from Ramadi, which has been captured by the Islamic State. And we've been talking more recently about the expansion of NATO exercises on countries bordering Russia. Now we're talking about China's growing influence around the world, whether it's in the Pacific, in the Mediterranean, and in Antarctica. And another important development in the past month is that Japan has been hinting that it will not apologize for World War II anymore as far as the future commemorations of the end of World War II go. And Japanese in the thousands are protesting U.S. military presence in Okinawa, where the U.S. is attempting to relocate an air base. Are the Japanese coming out from under the World War II sense of being the defeated nation? Are they going to try to become more independent? And if so, where does that leave them relationship to China?
When you want to understand the Japanese, you have to look at everything from a Japanese perspective. The Japanese are some of the most complex people on the planet. Their militantly nationalist party is called the Social Liberal Democratic Party. So, you know, the most innocuous sounding thing, and they're the most militantly nationalist. But one of the things when we look at, particularly the current prime minister, his family is intimately tied to the old regime of General Tojo, who was prime minister during World War II. He had relatives, his wife had relatives who were in Tojo's cabinet. So his mindset is a very nationalistic one, and so too is much of the Japanese people. However, the Japanese reaction to the defeat of World War II, if we look at it from a Japanese historical perspective, when a daimyo in the feudal period in Japan was defeated by another, or ultimately his people accepted the defeat, bowed their heads, and they became vassals of the new lord. When Japan was united under the first shogun, under a Minamoto shogun, the other daimyos, the other lords sort of bowed their heads and accepted, okay, well, this is our new overlord. When the Japanese give their word and they pledge their allegiance, their honor, saving face means everything. However, when they perceive weakness from their new master, their new overlord, they seek ways to circumvent the word that they gave. They're not going to tell the United States, who they became vassals to in their mind after the defeat in World War II. They're not going to openly say, you know what, you guys, we don't care what you think anymore. We're going to do what we want, because they still have to save face. Whenever a shogun in Japanese history would start, his power would start to wane. If we look, for example, at the Ashikaga shogunate, they began to weaken after the Onin Wars, and it became very clear to the other daimyos, the other lords, that the Ashikaga shogunate was no longer capable of truly controlling the country or exercising its authority. The daimyos all started vying for power, and that's when we got the Sengoku Jidai, the age of the country at war. And all these other daimyos decide they want to be shogun now. And so that's one thing we're starting to see repeat itself in Japanese history. Is now they're watching their shogun, their overlord, the shogun was the military dictator, starting to weaken, the United States starting to weaken, starting to become more vulnerable. And they're realizing, well, the U.S. doesn't have the ability to exercise its authority in the world. It doesn't have the ability to exercise its authority over the Chinese, over even the Middle East. So ergo, now it's time for Japan, for the lords of Japan, to now become the new shogun,
Japanese stand up against China?
Reasonably speaking, they can't actually stand up to the Chinese, because the Chinese military, the Chinese war machine is just so massive. But as the Japanese build their own war machine, the Japanese are experts at working in the shadows. During the time of the League of Nations, when there was a limit put on the size of the Japanese armed forces, they built it up in secret. They built the two largest warships in history. The Yamato and the Musashi were built in secret without knowledge of any of the other members of the League of Nations. The Japanese may be very well building up in secret. Very recently, they held an arms fair in Japan, and one of the things that was shown at that arms fair was Japanese armaments. So the idea that they're building their arms industry, because arms that you export overseas can very easily, very quickly be used for domestic consumption, because those same factories, instead of sending the guns overseas, can send them to the Japanese army. It's a very gradual process, but it's something that's begun to happen in Japan. And they're also looking at amending their constitution. The Japanese cabinet of Shinzo Abe, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, very recently passed a bill that's going to go before the Japanese Diet, the Japanese parliament, for approval was going to amend their interpretation of collective defense, whereby now if one of their allies is attacked, they can send troops to defend their allies. So if the United States of Europe have another 9/11 type scenario, the Japanese would now be able to deploy troops to assist us in operations, which is revolutionary because the Japanese Self-Defense Force was never before allowed to go overseas, you know, in combat operations. They went over to Iraq to provide humanitarian assistance, and even that was revolutionary. But now they're saying that they can actually go in a defensive capacity to defend their allies. This is a way for them now to branch the military out, to give their military a real military role as opposed to just a humanitarian disaster relief role.
Yeah, this also has an economic connection too, because the Japanese economy, as is well known, has stagnated for decades, as they've, you know, had the lost decade in the 90s and the 2000s, and they've run out of ways of how to build up their infrastructure with public money to try to push their economy forward. And I think that this may have a double-edged benefit for the Abe administration to put a lot of young Japanese men to work and to be able to spend money on domestically produced armaments and so forth, that they may look at the West's, the Americans' model of the military-industrial complex as a huge boom for the economy and think this may be something they should copy.
Well, when you look at history, I mean, you look at the Germans coming out of the Great Depression, one of the things that really boosted the German economy, one of the things that made Hitler so popular was his massive investment in German industry, particularly arms industry. Right. Krupp, who now manufactures coffee makers. You know, I have a Krupp coffee maker. They were an armaments manufacturer, and they built a tremendous amount of factories to manufacture tanks and guns for the German army. You know, that really helped revitalize their economy. And so for the Japanese, that's a similar model. The Japanese are a warrior society. Military service has been the highest calling. After World War II, it had to become something else. It became business, it became finance. Well, a peasant could join the Japanese army after the opening of Japan and basically become, in their mind, samurai, a status symbol, to become a warrior. After the end of World War II, to become a banker or a lawyer or an engineer, you had to graduate Tokyo University, top of your class. So it completely undercut the working class of Japan and is one of the many reasons why Japanese have the highest suicide rate per capita of any country in the world. When I was living in Japan, there were kids in the high school I went to who committed suicide because they didn't get high enough test scores. In the days of the Japanese army, if you didn't get very high test scores, well, the army was always your way to go because it was a way of having social status, even though you weren't necessarily the brightest person, you didn't come from money, but it gave you status. And so now that sort of restoring that will also restore a sense of purpose for the Japanese youth that, well, I come from a family of farmers, but here now I can move up in the world because I'm joining the army. Mm-hmm. And there's also the perception of the army has changed because I saw an interview with a Japanese mother who said, you know, she's watching the Defense Forces parade. And she said, well, when my son joined the army, I was very upset at first, but now I'm much more accepting of the idea that my son is a soldier and that, you know, this is a position of importance in Japanese society, which is a complete departure from the old mentality where if you join the self-defense force, it was an element of embarrassment.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I am Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator and producer, Gus Cantavero. We've been talking about, most recently, about the advances of China around the world and the tendency of the Japanese to rearm and cast a new, more aggressive role in the world. Now, of course, there's a presidential election coming up next November, and even though it's a long way till the general election, a lot of candidates are coming forward. Gus Cantavero is taking a look at some of them with a view to checking out their positions on foreign policy and war. Which party do you want to start with, the Republicans or the Democrats?
Let's start with the Democrats, because there's really, at this point, only two candidates to talk about. Martin O'Malley is still kind of on the periphery, and I personally not researched
him yet. Well, he made a statement that he does not want to talk about foreign policy issues.
Right, right. So there's really not a lot to talk about.
Not sure why he's running for president, but that's his view. But
he wants the upgrade. He wants to be in first class, you know.
Well, he wants to cash in some points, I guess.
So let's start with the Democrats then.
All right. Yes. So the candidate that everybody really thinks of first when they think of Democrat candidates at this point is Hillary Clinton. And she really has a lot of baggage when it comes to foreign policy. Let's just go back to when she was a senator. She was a big supporter of the Iraq War. I think we all know she voted for pretty much everything that the president asked for post 9/11. But then again, so did most of Congress, really, with the exception of Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul. So the exceptions there are pretty few, to be fair. She has been dodging the press on all of her campaign stops pretty relentlessly, giving them only a couple of minutes here and there. But she did finally come out and say that she has reversed her opinion on the Iraq War and that she made a mistake. And I think that that was a very, very smart political move for her. Whether she really believes it or not, I don't know. But it was a very smart move nonetheless. She's still plagued by other secrecy issues, such as her secret email account that she had as Secretary of State that kept all of her emails secret. She still has the Benghazi scandal. She's still refusing to take questions from the media about any of that. She's tied to the hip with the Obama administration because she was the Secretary of the State under his first administration. And that was a much more aggressive administration than it has been under Kerry as Secretary of State, who has been much more likely to negotiate and take a soft stance with these opposing nations. And in recent days, we've seen, for example, the Iran nuclear negotiations really start to gain some steam.
And she has a real problem with that because so much of her support comes from Israel. Between 2008 and 2013, the Clinton Family Foundation received $8 million from Israeli billionaire Chaim Sabin. $8 million. He recently met with her, and he claims that she assured him that she would not support the Iran.
That she would repudiate.
That she would not support it. Publicly, though, she says she thinks it's a good idea. So I don't know where the truth lies. Publicly, she is supporting
That's exactly why I said I don't believe what she says, because I think it's clear to say that she is the most insider candidate of everybody running.
And it's amazed to me. I was amazed to learn that the Clinton Foundation has also received millions of dollars from the corporate media.
There you go.
Gifts amounting from between $1 and $5 million include gifts from James Murdoch to Fox, Carlos Slim, who is the largest New York Times shareholder, and Thomson Reuters, who's the owner of Reuters News Service. Mm-hmm. So she also received large donations from people associated with CNN, CBS, NABC. And it makes
you
wonder.
George Stephanopoulos.
Yes, George Stephanopoulos. So it makes you wonder how objective can the media be in covering the presidential race when they're giving large sums of money to a candidate's foundation.
Exactly. And that kind of begs the question, if she were to become president, what kind of softball coverage would she be getting from these people who are her backroom buddies?
Yeah, who's supposed
in the media?
They're supposed to be the fourth branch of government, right?
Who's watching the Watchmen at this
looks like we have one branch of government. It's the corporate government.
Whoever's got the checkbook. Also, it's important to say that she supports the Trans-Pac partnership, the Trans-Pacific partnership that's currently being discussed with President Obama. Brings us to Bernie Sanders, who is pulling far behind Clinton, but I think it's very important to have an opposition who is able to push her from the left. He is very opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He says that it would kill American jobs, although personally I say it's a little bit late to the party to protect American manufacturing jobs. I think that's already been fairly destroyed under Bill Clinton. You know, and George Bush.
Ironically, a Democrat, Clinton comes in and he pushes through NAFTA in partnership with big business.
Bernie Sanders does have the benefit of being on record from opposing the Iraq War from the start. Under today's current situations, he wants Saudi Arabia to shoulder most of the fighting load and the paycheck for fighting against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. I can refer you back to the beginning of the show when we talked about that convoluted mess and how asking Saudi Arabia to get more involved may be a disaster of even bigger proportions. But I get the sense when I research Bernie Sanders' foreign policy that it's very confused. Because that he takes half measures on some issues. He has wanted out of Afghanistan since 2011, but he's totally unclear on what he proposes that he would do with ISIS. Like I mentioned, he wants Saudi Arabia to take the lead. He wants less war effort by the United States, but he still wants the United States to bomb. He doesn't want the United States to have boots on the ground. So really, where do you draw the line here? You really don't want to get involved with more involved with Saudi Arabia, because that would just make things much worse. He supports the Iran nuclear negotiations by Obama, but he does accept what I consider propaganda that Iran wants a nuclear weapon, because it's already been shown by many, many journalists that they never had a nuclear weapon program, and pretty much all the intelligence agencies agree on that. But he does say that he wants to avoid a war with Iran at all costs. He did support the Israeli invasion of Gaza in 2014, but he did say that Israel overreacted, and that's a quote in his words, by bombing schools and the shelters. Sanders did boycott the Netanyahu speech in March, but he is Jewish and he's deeply supportive of Israel. But it's clear that he's not a fully owned war hawk Zionist like Netanyahu is. Speaking of war hawk Zionists, that brings us to the Republicans. Chiefly Marco Rubio, who is definitely, even though he's not Jewish, the biggest Zionist supporter in the entire race. He seems to support any and all military inventions previously thought of or yet to be proposed. He supported the Libya intervention, and he said he would have even done more. He said the only thing wrong with the Libyan intervention was that it wasn't big enough. He wants more sanctions on Iran. He supports the Patriot Act and NSA spying, and he wants a permanent extension to the Patriot Act. To me, Rubio is a nightmare. The only one worse than him for me is Hillary Clinton. That's only because of the domestic issues. Rubio is a complete basket case when it comes to foreign policy.
It's hard to believe the Republican Party used to be the party that was opposed to foreign intervention, really, until
World War II. Well, what does the word conservative mean? It means to withdraw from things, to take things easy, right? These guys are not conservative. Marco Rubio and John McCain, George Bush, now Jeb Bush, they are not conservative. Can we just get that out in the open right now? These guys want to spend money like it's water, you know, like it doesn't mean anything. And that's exactly what causes things like inflation, loss of jobs, broken infrastructure, spending money on blowing things up. You're actually spending money to break something.
Well, how did it come about that the Republican Party, which historically had opposed foreign intervention, I mean, you go back to
World War I, II, Korea, Vietnam, the conservative party really did oppose all of these wars. And it was a Democrat president that was in charge of World War I, World War II, Vietnam, Korea. And it wasn't until post-Vietnam, where it became the military-industrial complex's rule of everything, really maybe during Vietnam, I guess, if you want to split hairs.
Yes.
But after that, and especially now, compounded 100 times with the war on terror, you have a spending spree for the military-industrial complex, a destruction and shredding of the Constitution, and it's bipartisan.
And it's bipartisan, but the Republicans seem to be like the most enthusiastic advocates of military expansion. And I think that one of the things we want to do in this show is remind people that historically this country was not dedicated to, did not have a
warmongering empire.
Yeah, we didn't have a bipartisan support for expansionism. And if you look at American history, you see that America rose to prosperity in the first century of the Republic in a policy of non-intervention designed by George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. We became one of the world's leading economic powers, with the exception of our invasion of part of Mexico. Pretty much we steered clear of foreign wars. We paid a dear price. The War of 1812 was largely brought about because of Thomas Jefferson's policies of staying out of the European war between Napoleon and the British. And it really wasn't until 1898 and the Spanish-American War that we got into the empire game.
It's a lot of years of prosperity in between.
Yeah, and we really did very well without this interventionist policy.
All right, so just to round out the race, Rand Paul is clearly the most non-interventionist candidate in the entire race, though he doesn't go as far as his father, the former Air Force surgeon Ron Paul. He favors a gentler hand dealing with other countries, working toward an eventual complete release. So he really does not want to be involved in telling all the countries how they should run their foreign policy and who their leaders should be, which is kind of refreshing. He favors ending all foreign aid, though not all on day one. He wants a general scale down, and he wants to save Israel for last. He wants American representatives to authorize wars. He wants to scale down the executive branch. He was a big critic of the Libyan intervention. He opposed the Syrian intervention. He is more supportive of Iran negotiations than the other Republicans, but he's still pretty tough on it. And he did sign that now famous document with other senators saying that they wanted to oppose this negotiation. He's also highly opposed to all domestic spying, as is evidenced by Wednesday's filibuster of the reauthorization of the Patriot Act. And so I think it's fair to say that he really does put his money where his mouth is on domestic privacy issues. Ted Cruz is really in between Rand Paul and Marco Rubio. He's a big supporter of the military. He is a hawk on domestic spending, but he's a huge supporter of military strength. He does say it should be used with caution, but then I say that border always ends up getting pushed and you always have mission creep. So when you say you're going to be someone with a careful hand to send military interventions, to me, that just means that you need to make, you know, find the right threat to be involved with, and then your borders will be pushed every single time. And eventually it just becomes to the point where it is now where you send a military to go do anything. Jeb Bush is so obsessed with his own family's legacy that he is willing to sound like a moron on public television. He's double-backed on Iraq. He's changed his answers depending on public reactions because they did not like his reaction when he said that he would have invaded Iraq. He came back a couple days later and said that, no, he misheard the question. He wouldn't have. Really, it sounds like he just wants to get elected.
And yet Jeb Bush is perceived by the press or portrayed by the press as a more moderate Republican, less aggressive.
He's Obama. I don't see how this is any different.
So he epitomizes sort of the one-party state.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He wants more action against ISIS. He's a big supporter of the NSA spying. As of today, I mean, he may change his mind tomorrow. He would not have invaded Iraq. Okay, so he has that going for him. He's attacked Obama's negotiations with Iran because he believes it's not strong enough and believes that the U.S. has an obligation to protect our interests in other countries. Again, there's that word, our interests. What are our interests? Can you define them? I mean, because me personally, as Gus in Connecticut, has no interest in Libya. Okay, so he has interest in Libya or whatever.
Well, you know? Isn't that interesting that the debate has always assumed that our interests, the national interests, were being served by our foreign policy? But if you look at the foreign policy, really since Bush Sr. and the attack on the Persian Gulf, it's really been the interests of oil companies that's been protected.
And that's why our interests, and I use air quotes there, is such a broadly vague term. Because whose interest? American corporations' interests or certain select wealthy Americans' interests? Like, you need to define your terms more.
And that's right. And there's that old saying, what's good for General Motors is good for the country.
Sure.
Well, that's not true. And in this show, we want to emphasize we're not partisan. We're not coming at this from a conservative, liberal, and ideologic point of view. We're really coming at it from a popular point of view. We want the foreign policy of the United States to serve the interests of the American people and the American nation. And it doesn't do so when it's...
And be fair for other countries.
And be fair. And it doesn't do so if its highest priority is maximizing
profits. Right. Just because we're powerful doesn't mean we ought use that power. Ben Carson is not well-versed in foreign policy, and he pretty much shies away from talking about it. He has supported boots on the ground against ISIS to wipe them out and go to war with Iran should they develop a nuclear weapon. Scott Walker wants boots on the ground against ISIS, is also critical to deal with Iran. And there's that name, Rick Perry, from last time, which I'm hoping doesn't stay on the list very long. He wants boots on the ground against ISIS, more weapons and training for Syrian rebels, and he would repudiate the deal with Iran if he were to become president, lest that happen.
And I recently heard Senator Lindsey Graham tell a cheering audience, if anyone thinks of even joining the Islamic State, I will kill him. It seems like these candidates feel that they have to be more macho than anybody else. They have to be tougher. And this is not a foreign policy.
I don't see Lindsey Graham signing up to fight, though.
No.
I will kill them when I authorize a drone to do it.
Exactly. It just seems to be a macho game, and it's not really serving the best interests of the American people. Marshawn, you're more in touch with the thinking of the soldiers, the army. What candidate do you think represents their best interests in terms of military policy, foreign policy?
Ron Paul, I think, was probably the strongest, and he commanded a lot of support from the military because he had a policy of military strength, but it was really the Teddy Roosevelt speak softly and carry a big stick. You know, you want to keep your enemies at bay, but at the same time, you don't want to go and antagonize those you don't have to. But then in the same vein, Rand Paul is not his father. I mean, he signed on to the Support Ukrainian Freedom Bill, which basically authorized the arming of the Ukrainians, which was invariably going to antagonize the Russians. So right now, I mean, the military seems fairly split. My impression is Jeb Bush commands some support, but there really isn't one Republican candidate, at least at this stage, that really commands the support of the military. The only thing that one could say for certain is the military is very adamantly opposed to and worried about a Hillary Clinton administration, because Obama's made a lot of bungling decisions in addition to shrinking tremendously the size of the military in light of a threat coming from an entity like ISIS, and at the same time antagonizing the Russians.
Are soldiers worried that an overly aggressive president is going to get us involved in a war and get a lot of American troops killed?
I think part of the fear is that an overly aggressive president is going to ignore threats like ISIS. I mean, because I think that that's part of the fear with the Obama administration. Obama's ignoring ISIS, but then at the same time antagonizing the Russians. And nobody has any illusions that a war with Russia, even if we won it, it would be a Pyrrhic victory, because so many thousands or hundreds of thousands of Americans would be killed. And so I think that's something that right at this stage, the military is very worried about the fact that a new president coming in might weaken the armed forces, which will leave us vulnerable to attack by somebody like ISIS, and then at the same time continue to antagonize the Russians and the Chinese, which could potentially lead to a large-scale global war, which would kill thousands of Americans.
Well, that's it for this edition of the In Context War Report. The In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., as broadcasted from noon to 1 on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. This program will be archived at WPKN.org, at RadioForAll.org, and our show's website, IncontextReport.com. And you can sign up for podcasts of the series via iTunes and Radio for All, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. On behalf of In Context Military Affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe and producer Gus Canavero, this is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Thanks for listening. See you next time.